Hello, well, many thanks for that kind introduction, Brendan. And yeah, very warm welcome. It's a pleasure to be here. As Brendan said, I arrived this morning and was excited to see some snow and actually some real winter weather, so that's great. I was surprised to see a big Christmas tree downstairs, but yeah, coming from Germany, you know, that's nice this time of the year, but it's not necessarily what I would have expected as the sort of first cultural sign when I walk in somewhere in Beijing, but there you go. I hope, you know, let's just keep this fairly informal. You know, I've got a couple of slides, and, you know, as this is a topic that I have been working on for a long time, you know, once I get going, you know, I can talk forever about this, but I try to kind of focus on a couple of aspects that I hope might be interesting to you. But, you know, if there's anything that I haven't mentioned or anything that, you know, you want to pick up, you know, by all means, use this as an opportunity. In fact, so that's kind of roughly what I have in mind. Let's see if we can manage all that in 30 minutes. And I can make the slides available if anyone is desperate to read it afterwards. But before we start, I wanted to turn over to you and just ask you a couple of questions. You know, just to kind of feel the temperature and just to see, you know, if people are aware of this broad subject of, you know, climate change, natural disasters and so on. And, you know, I'll go through a lot of these aspects in detail later on. So, you know, just as a kind of question over to you. So can anyone name a global policy initiative that was or is going to be negotiated this year in the context of climate change, natural disasters, and poverty? Any ideas? Anybody aware of such a global policy initiative?
Mm-hmm. Millennium
Goals, I think. Yeah, the Millennium Goals, which have now been renamed. Does anybody know the name? Sustainable Development Goals, yeah. They were, I think, agreed in August. Yep. Anything else? Yep, that's the one that's starting next week. So hopefully there will be some sort of policy conclusions. And then there was one earlier this year, and that's probably the one that people are not aware, although it happened not that far from here.
Hillgo Framework.
Yeah, do you know what the new name is?
I don't know, sorry.
The Sendai Framework.
Oh, so
yeah. So that's the UN's disaster risk reduction framework, and that was agreed on in March this year. So three policy events, all sort of coordinated at UN level, and all sort of homing in on, you know, climate change, natural disasters, and poverty. So, you know, I'll say a few words about that later on, but just to... Some people say that 2015 could be a really important year in this area. Well, it's coming to a close, so let's see if that really can deliver. The next question, can you guess the percentage of development aid that is spent on disaster preparedness and resilience? It's one of my most favorite shocking statistics. And there's a clue. Yeah. Yeah, not bad. Not bad. Okay. So for every $100 that's spent on development aid, 40 cents are spent on preparedness and making basically those $100 resilient and protecting them from disasters and impact. So not a lot. And then when you look at, okay, we then have some dead, you know, of those 40 cents, most of that is actually going into recovery and emergency response. And very, very, very little goes into preparedness and prevention. And I think that's you know, if there's one thing for you to take home, you know, no matter how many events we experience, no matter where in the world, no matter what kind of government, organization, so we really struggle with this sort of prevention idea and taking measures ex ante rather than, you know, reacting afterwards. And, you know, that's sort of a theme. And I'll pick up on that later. And then the last thing, what was the most costly natural disaster? Yeah, that's tricky. Yeah.
Earthquake,
yes. But yeah, okay, well, you're getting into the type, but I'm looking for a particular one. Katrina is part of the top 10, I think, yeah. Okay, I'm going to show you two tables now. Well, you can't obviously read that. So that is the deadliest events, the 10 deadliest events, so most people killed. The top one is the Haiti earthquake. Then you had the tsunami, the earthquake in that sort of affected Indonesia, Thailand, cyclone, and the list goes down. So you'll realize that most of those happened in, you know, what one could call developing countries or emerging countries. And then I show you another statistic. Those are the costliest events in terms of economic loss. And then you have the Japan earthquake, the top. You have Hurricane Katrina as the second. Japan earthquake again, China earthquake, Hurricane Sandy. So you obviously notice that the two lists are quite different. And, you know, that's an interesting feature of, you know, we're talking about natural disasters and we're talking about, you know, sort of future climate impacts. You know, they're two very different categories. You know, loss of life, impacts on individuals is a huge issue, you know, in particular vulnerable countries and developing countries. Total economic loss is a huge issue in fairly rich countries. But I'm going to show you one statistic which actually shows that in absolute terms, the losses and impacts are, you know, are huge in Japan and the US. But compared to GDP, you know, these countries can absorb it. While, you know, a country that's just sort of on the development path, that's just sort of on the way out of poverty, you know, that can easily get a big knock when a disaster happens. So, again, it's important to keep in mind we have loss of life and economic loss. And then the last thing here to notice, there's then also a difference between the total loss that a disaster can cause and then the insured loss. And I'll come back to that in a minute, because that sort of shows you how well a country is absorbing financial losses. And usually when there is a high level of insurance penetration, the country is fairly stable and wouldn't really see a big impact in terms of GDP. Again, it can sort of recover fairly quickly. So, you know, these are just some pictures to illustrate, you know, what we're talking about. So, you know, natural disaster. You know, what makes a natural event, a weather event or an earthquake, what makes that into a real catastrophe? It's not so much just, you know, the hazard, you know, the pure natural force. I mean, okay, that is the sort of cause in a way. But what determines whether this is, you know, an event or a disaster or a catastrophe is actually, you know, the fact that it hits human settlements, it hits assets, it hits sort of vulnerable people. And a lot of people therefore argue actually there's not that much natural about a disaster. It's more sort of a natural event that then becomes a human disaster, a human-made disaster. And I think that's important to keep in mind. And that's that sort of equation. So the catastrophe risk is made up of exposure. That's basically what's out there, what you put in the way of a disaster. Vulnerability is, you know, the way that a country or a community or an individual is able to cope, you know, to respond. Do they have some alternative options? Do they have, you know, shelter where they can go? Are there business continuity plans that sort of protect a business? And then hazard, that's sort of the, you know, the event, the scale of an earthquake or the force of a windstorm. But that's important to keep in mind, particularly when we're talking about climate change. I mean, the climate aspect only comes in the last bit, in the hazard bit. The sort of climate, as it's currently understood, you know, climate change is having an impact on severity and frequency of disasters to various extents, and one has to be quite careful in making sort of broad brush statements. But overall, you know, the science community agrees that climate change is having an impact on natural catastrophes. But that's the hazard side. What we then make of that and how we let that impact our way of life, you know, our countries, communities, businesses, that's the exposure and vulnerability element. And that's basically what we can, you know, what we could easily address and what we're trying to address. That's much easier to address than the hazard bit. So the whole sort of climate change negotiations about limiting, you know, global warming up to 2 degrees, as we will see in the discussion in Paris next week, that's about the hazard component. And of course, that's hugely important, but that's kind of part of the equation. Because when you talk about natural disasters, I always say, you know, even without climate change, we would have a big natural disaster problem. Because we just tend to build in the wrong places, and, you know, for good reasons. I mean, you know, if you want to have a strong port, if you want to have an expanding economy, you need to be close to transport ways, and you need to be at coastal areas for whatever reasons. And unfortunately, you know, those are the areas that are currently already quite sort of impacted and are likely to be impacted even more. So, I don't know if anyone has seen this. I mean, this is a famous graph from, well, this one is actually from Swiss Re. I was just going to say from Munich Re, but yeah, Swiss Re. I mean, they both Swiss Re and Munich Re are the two largest reinsurers, and they've done for decades now research and trying to understand, you know, natural disasters, what's driving them. And a lot of people look at this graph and say, oh yeah, of course, here's climate change is happening, you know, natural catastrophe losses are going up, we need to do something. I always say, well, you know, I'm sure, and most scientists agree, there is a little bit of climate change in there that's pushing this. But again, coming back to this equation, it's mainly exposure and vulnerability that's pushing up these catastrophe losses. So, you know, as you can see, there is a trend, uninsured losses, you know, with a lot of spikes, but the trend's going up. Insured losses is also going up, slightly more, you know, less dramatic, because, you know, we just don't have much insurance coverage in lots of places in the world. But that's sort of what a lot of people are concerned about when they talk about natural disasters. I mentioned this earlier, this sort of impact, you know, if a natural disaster strikes, you know, you have the immediate impact, you have short-term impacts, you know, people out of homes, businesses might struggle operating, you might have impacts on their supply chains. A lot of you will be familiar with the Thai floods that basically knocked out certain supply chains for certain sectors and hit you know, a lot of businesses around the globe who weren't actually factoring this in. So, you know, they were aware that, you know, Thailand was facing some flood risk issues, but a lot of big companies were caught by surprise when actually a whole business area was completely knocked out. And, you know, there were interesting stories about this then having an impact on share prices. I think one needs to be careful in drawing conclusions about that, but, you know, no doubt when a disaster strikes, it can have economic impacts. how long those impacts last and whether those impacts are really sort of getting an economy off their development path or their growth path. That's another question. For example, with Japan, after the 2011 tsunami, was it 2011? Yeah, I think 2011. Some people were actually arguing, well, you know, it's obviously a dramatic catastrophe, huge, significant, but for the Japanese economy, it's probably not a bad thing because it could stimulate a lot of activity, construction, and so on. Yeah, that's, you know, that's always possible. And, you know, I think there's evidence that actually for certain sectors, Japan was very quickly in recovering and you know, coming back to where they were before. But a lot of other countries just don't have the capacity. So if a disaster hits a, you know, an emerging economy that has, you know, worked quite hard in terms of, you know, establishing new businesses in some areas, maybe building new infrastructure, and that infrastructure gets knocked out, you know, for that country, you know, usually when a disaster strikes, it means they have to shift budget, so they have to reallocate spending, sometimes away from education, away from health, just into the disaster recovery. And, you know, that can have then implications, for example, in terms of their efforts to reduce poverty. Some people have said there's a poverty trap. So, you know, if you look at a farmer, you know, they've just managed to get their way out of poverty, have sort of received some sort of grant support, have established, you know, their farm and are producing, and a disaster happens, you know, unless there's a safety network or, you know, insurance or, you know, some government support, you know, that farmer could easily be sort of go back to where you started because of a disaster. So, you know, that's that's just important. To me, the main issue with disasters is to, you know, they can be a huge disruption at various levels. Individual, a farmer or homeowner, businesses, localities, some municipalities have to deal with it, all the way up to national governments. And then globally, you know, remember this figure I gave about the development aid. I mean, it's amazing how many NGOs are sort of focusing on disaster recovery. And, you know, whenever there's a big disaster, big event, a lot of countries, so OECD countries, then pledge some support. And I think in the past, at least, you know, there was a bit of a cycle, a lot of governments in developing countries heavily relying on those, you know, pledges and, you know, basically assuming that if a disaster happens, someone else will come and support them. And that then setting, you know, well, a disincentive to actually do prevention in the first place. And I think that's sort of a problem that comes back to my first point. You know, we really struggle with, you know, doing ex-ante prevention work. I mentioned this thing about climate change. And just to illustrate, these are some figures that some of my colleagues in the Netherlands who I worked with in a project, they've looked at flood losses in Europe, and they've looked at various climate change scenarios up to 2050. And they did some calculations. So, you know, what we're currently seeing as flood losses and what we could see by 2050. You know, again, you know, the figures are quite dramatic. So currently we have an annual average loss of about 4.2 billion euros. And they say that could rise up to 23.5 billion euros. Well, as with every scenario and with every calculation, you know, there's usually a wide spread of potential outcomes. But I think, you know, the signal that this sends is, you know, let's focus on vulnerability and exposure management, because with that, we can at least buffer that sort of climate change impact and can try and, you know, and reduce that. And that's usually what people call the adaptation side of climate change. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but when you talk about climate change, usually you think about reducing emissions. And that's going to be the big thing in Paris next week, you know, which country does what and how they commit and various countries having pledged to do certain things. But the second chunk of that is, you know, what can we do to actually prepare for climate change and for these impacts? Because, you know, yes, we're trying to limit future emissions, but there is a lot of emissions already in the system. So, you know, in the short and near term, you know, we will be exposed to some, you know, more volatile, maybe more extreme, more frequent disasters. So what can we do? How can we adapt to that? And again, coming back to the risk equation, that's the exposure and vulnerability element. You know, can we have better business continuity plans? Can we have better building structures? Can we have better planning policy? Can we make sure that the infrastructure that we're putting in place now, where we're spending a huge amount of money now, can we make sure that that's, you know, resilient and that infrastructure, that new airport, that new port facility, the new highway, that they will actually be able to cope with a climate in 20, 25 years? You know, that sounds fairly logic in a way, but you know, it's actually quite scary how often infrastructure projects go ahead without any consideration of, okay, have you actually thought about, you know, potential disaster impacts, and have you thought about how that particular factory will be able to cope with water shortage? Because we're not just talking about flooding and storms and earthquakes. Droughts, lack of water. You know, there are interesting stories of hydropower plants, huge investments going on. And I've spoken to a couple of people in one of the major banks that was funding it, and they said, well, only at the very end of the process, someone said, well, have we actually asked hydrologists in terms of what we can expect? You know, water availability in this area where we are now building a huge hydropower plant. And then people realized that, well, maybe it shouldn't have been at the end, but at the beginning, because the location was bound to face some significant droughts going forward. So, you know, it's this, that's what makes it so challenging. So there is the climate change element, yes, no doubt, but there is a huge human element. And, you know, to me, that's actually the one that we could, you know, without too much, you know, hope for some miracle solutions, address. Okay, well, even less for you to read. But this is the share of populations exposed to coastal flooding. And if I can read it here. Right, supposed to be China, that big one there. I mean, you can just see that's the sort of world map. Population exposed to coastal flooding seems to be mainly in Asia and big time in Asia. I mean, we know that Bangladesh is a low-lying country, so coastal flooding there obviously is an issue, but in other countries as well. And there has actually been a World Bank study looking at urbanization trends. And, you know, where are the future or the current and future mega cities? I mean, if you think about it, you know, they are often in highly exposed areas. I mean, Asia is already, you know, you have earthquakes here, cyclones, you know, coastal flooding. So, you know, there is already quite a lot going on here. So, you know, urbanization, with all its positives, but, you know, it also means that the risks are going to be increasing. So, you know, I mean, I'm not sort of trying to paint a bleak picture here, because I think, you know, that obviously it's frustrating to realize that we are not very good at preparing for these risks, and that we still seem to go through the cycle of putting something, then realizing after an event that maybe it wasn't the smartest thing to put it there, rebuilding it, hopefully making that new school slightly more resilient, and then 10 years down the line going through the same cycle because maybe then the water came from a different angle and you weren't prepared for that. It's kind of a cycle that you know, we'll tend to be going through, you know, just learning the lessons from disasters. And, you know, it's quite human and quite natural. But, you know, you wonder whether these day and age we could, you know, not be a bit more foresighted and try, and at least in these big projects, like big infrastructure projects, to sort of make sure that that's being considered at the early stages. And most policymakers would agree with that, and most policymakers are trying actually to set some rules or find some ways of addressing this. And those are the three policy frameworks that, you know, you identified earlier. I'm not going to go through them in detail because we don't have enough time, but I just want to highlight that, you know, they are all obviously fairly loose in terms of, you know, the commitment. When you sign up to that, it's sort of a guidance. It sets a framework. It gives you an idea of, you know, what aspects to aspire to. But ultimately, it's down to national governments, regional, local, and then also to the private sector and individuals to actually, you know, address those. And, you know, the question is then, well, how, you know, who's actually able to address those, and who's actually able to make decisions that will influence or shape, you know, our future infrastructure. So I think, you know, it's great to have these policy frameworks there, and, you know, with Paris, well, we'll see what's happening next week. But, you know, that's, it sends a signal, but the real work is happening at a different level. And that's also something that is a problem or a challenge here in China. I mean, I'm just briefly highlighting that because I'm by no means I'm an expert on you know, what's going on in China. I just know that you know, there is a plan. It's called the Comprehensive Disaster Prevention and Reduction Plan. It's sort of led by the National Committee for Disaster Reduction. So, you know, it's all institutionalized. But then implementing that and making sure that all these various departments, the one that is driving infrastructure, the one that's driving agricultural development, the one that is responsible for business growth, I mean, you name it, various departments, to make sure that, you know, that becomes kind of a theme throughout. You know, that's a challenge. And, you know, obviously China being a huge country, you know, how you actually reach from the top to the local level is a challenge. So insurance in China is common in the agriculture sector, but not very common in the property sector. In fact, I'm going to a conference in 2 days' time hosted by the British Embassy, where there are some discussions with companies, private sector insurers, the Chinese government, facilitated by the British Embassy, about developing a new approach to insurance for disasters. So, you know, discussions have been going on for a long time, but let's see what, you know, what can be done. So, very briefly, I mean, again, you might have noticed my sort of infrastructure theme here. You know, talking about the importance of infrastructure and all this, you know, we can't just underestimate it. But it also points towards the private sector, because actually who ends up delivering infrastructure and who ends up putting things there, you know, a lot of that is either invested or built by the private sector. And, you know, there's a huge opportunity for private sector companies. And, you know, there is evidence that a lot of companies, you know, they they really take this serious. Usually, again, after they've been hit by an event, you know, if one of your supply chains has fallen down, has broken down, you're then likely to sit down and consider your continuity plans or develop new supply chain management. And, you know, there are lots of different terminologies that companies are using. And I sometimes think, you know, we get all excited about climate change and disaster and so on. But a lot of companies, I mean, for them, it's just part of enterprise risk management and due diligence. So I think sometimes, you know, policymakers could actually learn quite a lot in terms of efficient management of those risks. But, and that's sort of a big but, usually that only applies to global multinationals who have the capacity to actually have a dedicated team. When you then look at smaller companies, you know, they really struggle with factoring these risks into their supply chain. I just did a survey of SMEs in England, and, you know, I think about 70% just don't have a business continuity plan. You know, if their building burns down, okay, well, then they consider what next, but they just don't have a plan. And, you know, nobody has ever asked them to have one or taught them to have one. So, you know, there is certainly a role for the private sector. And just usually when you say private sector disaster, people think, oh, wait a moment, we have insurance. Here's your prime example of a private sector being quite interested in disaster losses. Well, why they're interested, they pay for part of these damages. But I think, you know, insurance can also bring quite a lot in terms of our understanding, our analytical approach, and, you know, you've seen the statistics from Swiss Re. So there's a lot of potential of what the private sector, in this case insurers, can bring to managing risk. But I think for me, the key question is, can they also help us to switch from this post-disaster focus, recovering, rebuilding, to be more preventive? And, you know, the verdict is still out. I mean, yes, insurers have invented the fire service in the, I think, 18th century. So insurers have a tradition of being preventive and also, you know, imposing standards, safety, health and safety standards. But can they do the same with natural disasters? Can they impose that people comply with building codes? Can they impose businesses to have business continuity plans? Yes, but, you know, it's not happening. If you ask me, I think there's still a missed opportunity, and I think that's sort of where I see probably a big push that could be helped, where actually we're focusing on incentivizing this move from recovery to prevention. And just briefly, when you look at this picture, you see that insurance is really not used in many parts of the world. And, you know, even here, you know, the green bit is the overall losses from disasters, and then you see what share of that is insured. And, you know, there is potential to expand that, and here different types of disaster insurance, sovereign property, agriculture, microinsurance, you name it. But to me, the whole point is this, you know, trying to link all these instruments to this idea of incentivizing. You know, how can we actually not just pay someone after an event, but how can we actually use this to incentivize resilience? And that's kind of where my work currently focuses on, and I just want to give you a brief example here. This is from India. Sorry, I didn't pick one from China, but there's one from, I think, Vietnam, actually, down there as well. Anyway, this is a company, PepsiCo, using insurance to make its supply chain more resilient. So they provide weather risk advice and new seeds and some technological support to their contract farmers in order to make them more resilient. So, you know, if they are facing a disaster, then they get some payouts and they will recover more quickly. But the idea is also that through this advice, through the different seed technologies, they just become more resilient and more prepared and won't actually need these payouts from the weather insurance. And it's one small example. There are many others being tried and tested. But I think, you know, unless we can make that work, you know, it will be really hard to move to this idea of, you know, being more preventive than, you know, responding and rebuilding. And, well, I warned you, I mean, once I get going on this, I can talk for a long time. And, you know, I'm aware that a lot of these things might not be for you as, you know, as familiar, obviously, as they are for me. But I hope that this might have given you some food for thought and hopefully also some questions. And yeah, I think with that, maybe I close just with one question. Has anyone in the room been affected by a natural disaster, sort of personally? Okay. Yeah. Indirectly, maybe? Getting stuck somewhere at an airport. Yeah, yeah. Or having to pay more for, I don't know, for a certain food product. I think bread prices. There was sort of a big drought in Russia a couple of years ago. And then people were saying that that had an impact on wheat prices. Okay. No?
I've been not personally affected, I suppose, but I'm actually from Australia. In Australia, I volunteered for a state body called the State Emergency Services.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a division of the emergency services to volunteer. And so, actually, our main supporter was a big insurance company.
Okay.
And a lot of our work, most of the time, was about trying to promote resilience in communities. But I attended natural disasters interstate, so I was able to see and witness the effects.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I mean, Australia is also an example where, you know, obviously you're prone to some disasters, but I think some of the climate change projections also suggest, you know, the sort of situation in terms of, you know, more wildfires and drier scenarios there. Okay. Well, I think then we are also all quite lucky. I've only been visiting a few disaster sites when I was working for the industry, and I think it's quite important and quite humbling in a way to actually talk to people, you know, whose house has just been flooded or, you know, whose business has just disappeared, and, you know, to sort of, well, you just hope that you won't yourself be in such a situation, but, you know, to just see it, because it's also, it has a huge psychological impact. And maybe I'll just close with one kind of anecdote. When I was in Japan earlier this year for the Sendai UN conference, you know, it was a huge gathering. The Chinese, I think, I can't remember who from the Chinese government was there, but, you know, it was very high level with the Japanese emperor opening it. So very high level. There were a lot of people from small island states. And I think actually there was just a big storm in Vanuatu that was just so coinciding with the conference. And, you know, people were talking about the dramatic impacts that that had. And people from the Philippines were talking about their experience. And then there was a counselor from Cornwall in Great Britain. And, you know, obviously, you know, we had, you know, quite significant floods. Particularly last winter, very, you know, long-lasting floods. And then he was standing in front of this big global audience and saying, yeah, the main concern that his constituencies had were whether their pets would be able to survive in their houses after they had to leave their houses. And I thought, okay, well, you're telling this audience, you know, people from Philippines, from low-lying islands, you know, that in England the main thing we worry about is our pets. And I thought, you know, if that's our main worry, then, you know, we should actually be very grateful, because, you know, that by far is not on the agenda for a lot of people who basically fear either for their lives or their livelihoods. And I think, you know, that sometimes, you know, we'll just tend to forget. You know, if you want to be somewhere facing a disaster, it's probably not in a developing country, but, you know, in Japan, facing an earthquake is, you know, you can probably be a bit safer than elsewhere. And the same, you know, if you're facing a flood or a drought in a country which has already good infrastructure. So, yeah, I mean, hopefully nobody's offended, because pets are important, but I think there are also more important issues to worry about. So, any questions? That's a good question. It depends on how a company is structuring that, but usually it's a very operational thing, because it relates to your internal operations. Business continuity is, you know, what you do when, you know, your factory has been burned down, and what you do with the rest of your businesses. So it's a very, usually it wouldn't sit in the CSR team, because that's more outward looking. It, part of that is, you know, also your suppliers, and how do you select your suppliers, which is very relevant for corporate social responsibility. But the sort of hardcore, you know, what you do with your business when it's underwater. Usually I think that sits within the operational, you know, the facilities management. I don't know, do we have anyone working for a company who might know where their business continuity plan is? Or if they have one. Ah.
My university in Sydney, we actually had a department for emergency preparation and plan.
Okay. Well, in my former life, before I went back to LSE, I worked for a big insurance broker, and we had lots of business clients, so some major airlines, for example. And, you know, once a year we would sit down with them and go through all the locations where they are and check, you know, terrorism risk, earthquake risk, you name it, whatever you can throw at it, and just run through the scenario. Okay, what would you do? How quickly would you be able to cope? How can you rely on? And that would have an impact on how much money they would pay for insurance. So for them, there was a big incentive to actually be quite well prepared, because then the insurer would say, okay, well, you know, here, so you get a 20% discount on your insurance premium.
Same in LSE, within the business continuity unit.
Okay.
Also looking at, you know, where we are in the center of London.
Oh, yeah.
On terrorism risks, bomb risk, you lose that building, how do you continue to operate? Students that pay fees, you know, how do you manage all of that risk?
Yeah, I mean, you know, with terrorism risk, I think, you know, that was an awful reminder for a lot of people, just to check their business continuity plans. And I know a lot of banks, they have some sort of shadow facilities where they can move to some, you know, some warehouses somewhere out of town where they have a lot of their computers stored or so. I don't know, I'm sure it would be interesting to know how business continuity is conducted here in China. I mean, there were some non-natural disasters recently, and I think that raised, particularly with some insurers who actually paid quite a lot of money, I think Swiss Re paid a lot of money for that, and, you know, that raised some questions as well.
Yeah, I just want to add one example, and I heard an example about the risk management from JP Morgan for 911. They had a very good leader about security. They followed the instruction of this security leader, who got experience from the army, and to produce some kind of copy system, an operation system. And they went through the disaster of the 911, because they had all things, the software, the data. So my name is Ang Zhao. I study at the Department of the Digital Environment. I found you presented very interesting. And I have two questions. The first one is, if I'm, my understanding is correct, because insurance loss are related to only property, not life loss. That's the question one. The second one is that how do we explain why Chinese people and entities, including private and public, they don't really improve the insurance coverage in their operation, and compared to the Western countries, the EU and America. And if I can say a little bit more, why Japan probably has done quite a lot better than China. It's only economic facility and economic power, the major factor to influence people's choices, and other cultural or social factors. Thank you.
Okay, well, two very good questions. So the first one is the easier one. So the stats that I did show about insured losses and total losses. So usually, I need to be careful, usually loss of life isn't included in that. I know some people start quantifying, you know, any person that died from a disaster and try and monetize that and add that to the equation. I think that gets a bit tricky, but you can do that. But the stats I did show you, that was sort of loss in terms of assets, so property, business continued, business interruption, so you're losing, you know, production, you're losing sales, because you can also insure that. So that's that. Sometimes there is also liability, because, you know, that's interesting. Someone might sue you for not being prepared enough, or someone for not having done enough. That's an interesting one, for example, with some local governments. There's now, in several countries, there's now there are now cases where companies and individuals are suing their local government because they seem to have underestimated risks, or they seem to have allowed property developments in the wrong places. And, you know, that's an interesting one to watch, where suddenly planners are getting, you know, accused of having made the wrong decisions. But loss of life, in those stats, loss of life was excluded. The second question is, what determines how much a country uses insurance and how much a country is prepared? On the insurance side, a lot depends on the sort of tradition. If you take Japan, they've got a long tradition of using insurance as a tool. Also European countries, they've been using insurance for a long, long time. I mean, Lloyd's of London was created in 1600 something, and, you know, there's this, over that time there has been this concept of insurance being an accepted mechanism. In other countries, such as China, you had other sort of net structures that would protect you against disasters. So in a lot of countries, for example, in Africa as well, you have a lot of social structures and local communities. So when a disaster occurs, the community gets together. It's very informal, but, you know, it creates a protection mechanism. Then, you know, it's also the part of it is also income. So in order to buy insurance, you know, you need to have a certain income level. That's another aspect which explains why insurance is more used in so-called richer countries. You then have, you know, you need to have financial literacy. I mean, people need to understand what insurance is about, and because it's not a straightforward thing. And I'm sure a lot of people here, there are many more enjoyable things that you can do than signing up an insurance contract. And, you know, I'm not sure how many people enjoy dealing with their insurance company, or how many people think they can trust their insurance company, or they understand what insurers are actually charging them, or how insurers are calculating it. So, you know, that's all part of it which might make certain countries more reluctant to go down. And I'm not saying that insurance is, you know, is by far not the solution. It's just, I think there's a role for insurance to play, and in a lot of countries that role could be enhanced. I think, you know, in China it's interesting, agriculture insurance has been around since the 1950s. That's been states organized, so you have public insurance, state-funded insurance there. But then property insurance, I mean, you know, the idea of owning property, you know, that's not that, doesn't have such a long history. So I think that's not a big surprise that insurance is now only emerging. I think motor insurance is quite big here. On my way here from my hotel to this hotel, I think I saw 4 or 5 accidents where people were just taking pictures. And I think by taking that picture, you can already alert your insurance company. So I thought, wow, that's amazing. I mean, it's quite shocking to see 5 accidents within half an hour. But people were very calm. They just stood there and took a picture and probably just sent it off, and we're just hoping for the funds to come in. I mean, I don't know how it works, but any other questions? Yeah. Ah, that's a very good question. That's what people call the protection gap. That's a big concern, that you would think, you know, losses or the risk is increasing, more people want to buy insurance. That's not necessarily how it works, because usually when the risk increases, insurance might get more expensive. So people might say, no, I go without. Or insurers might walk away, might say, well, I'm not underwriting this anymore. It could also be that then the state has to come in and has to fill that gap and has to offer some alternative mechanisms to insurance. So that's actually, believe it or not, that's what's driving Munich Re and Swiss Re to produce all these stats and do all this research. It's this concern, you know, what's happening to our product? Are people going to be able to buy it? Are we going to be able to continue providing insurance cover? Or, you know, where's this going? And I think for me the answer is, you know, let's just work together to keep these risks under control, because then insurance will continue to be able to be affordable or available. Okay? Yeah?
Can you go to the graph of the percentage of insurance in the world?
And this big map?
Yes.
That one?
There. Yeah. You see Latin America, like overall losses, everything uninsured, right?
Well.
And that's where you're from.
Yeah, where I'm from. Like, in 2004, we have like the Niño that destroyed all our costs. Mm-hmm. Now we are facing a similar situation. Maybe the Niño is going to come again. That is a current flood of,
mm-hmm.
And it's bad. Then we have a volcano that is also about to explode.
Yeah.
And the oil prices went down like dramatically, so our economy relies on oil. So my question was, I come from a country where the traditional insurance is not big, right? And me, if let's say tomorrow I become a political actor, and I would like to install this new tradition of let's get insurance, I don't think locally we will have private insurers that will have the capacity to back the risk that we have, because we have massive natural disasters, right? And then how would I be able to, I think the only company that will be able to back that up would be the Swiss companies or the German companies, the German insurance mm-hmm. companies. And then politically, it will be very hard to sell
to the people that I want to get an insurance from abroad, because of the, as a government, I have to do a cost-benefit analysis to see if it's my role as the government to interfere, if the losses that the whole society will incur will be higher than the losses that. So I see like a huge political game here. I would love to like get a traditional insurance or two, but politically I don't see the feasibility of it, especially when we underestimate the risks of natural disasters. So I don't know how to, what would you say to that comment?
Okay, well, I think the situation in South America is slightly more diverse. So there are actually quite a few countries that have now sort of taken things into their own hands. And interestingly, Colombia is often cited as a country that has actually done a huge amount of work on disaster risk prevention. Actually, they have made it a legal requirement. It's one of the overall, again, I'm not quite sure where, you know, how you call it, but they have a legal requirement for disaster risk management to be factored in into decisions. And, you know, under that heading, they then start playing around with different tools, and insurance being one. So there is, in Chile, you mentioned that, there are some insurance pilots. There is actually a El Nino insurance, a forecast insurance. So you basically can insure against the forecast that you receive, that not being true. So you receive a forecast, you then plant according to that forecast. And then a few months later you realize, well, that was crap, and you know, started to rain a month earlier or didn't rain at all. So you can insure against that uncertainty with the forecast. So it's not at a big scale, and often it's actually small pilots supported by the American Development Bank. World Bank is quite heavily involved, and they're trying to experiment with that. And then you have companies such as Munich Re, Swiss Re coming in and support that. But to my mind, it's essential that you also then try and build the capacity nationally. So last year I was in Brazil, and the Brazilian Insurance Association, they are aware of that. They focus a lot on microinsurance, not necessarily just in terms of disasters, but general microinsurance, because their approach is, okay, let's just make sure that people understand insurance in the first place, and let's start with the simple insurance products, and then building on that, we could potentially offer them some disaster insurance. So, you know, I think there's a lot of movement, but it will also take time. And again, I don't think insurance is a solution in every context. And that's also my worry sometimes. I don't know if anyone of you remembers, we had this G7 summit in the summer. And one of the big announcements that came out of that, well, maybe only I realized it because I'm interested in insurance, but one of the big announcements there was that the G7 countries commit to insure 400 million people against climate risks over the next 5 to 10 years. So you say, wow, okay, that's an interesting commitment. You know, A, how is this going to happen? But are we sure that that insurance product is actually what, you know, what people really need? Or shouldn't we maybe start with the infrastructure and making sure that the infrastructure is more resilient? I mean, you know, there are different ways. I'm just not saying let's not just all go down the insurance route. But as you can see, there's a huge gap or, you know, blank spots where I'm sure insurance could play a more constructive role. There was another question? Yeah?
I'm Meng Yao, 2015 graduate, and first I want to thank you for your excellent presentation. My question is not a real question, but could you please share your expectations on the outcomes of the Paris Climate Conference? Obviously, there will be a lot of disagreements between developed countries and developing countries, even within developing countries like BRICS and the least developed countries. So could you please share your expectations?
Well, it's difficult. I mean, I have to say, I'm not, there are colleagues in my institute who kind of watching the negotiations day in, day out, and, you know, I try and focus on these things rather than just the negotiation. I think my overall take is that people are quite optimistic that there will be an agreement, that there will, I mean, we have already seen a lot of commitments, you know, so the Chinese government together with the US government, that's unprecedented. So you've seen a lot of commitments, a lot of targets being set by governments. And, you know, I think that has already pushed us to a different level. Interestingly, one of the key issues that's going to be discussed next week is the question of how do you address losses and damages arising from climate change. So that's a big issue where a lot of developing countries, particularly small island states, are pushing quite hard for a commitment from OECD countries to set aside a lot of money to compensate them, you know, when sea level rises and you know, their islands go underwater. You know, who pays them? I mean, we're not talking about insurance in that context. This is about an island disappearing, and where do people go? But that's kind of a key issue at the moment. You know, where, you know, how do you address that? And that's not, to me, it's not really an economic question. I mean, it's more like an ethical question. And then people start arguing, okay, well, is it really climate change that caused that island to suffer? Or, you know, could they not have done more to prepare for it? I mean, you face lots of tricky questions. But I think, you know, if all the world, global leaders who will be in Paris, you know, they don't want to come home empty-handed. So we'll see some form of agreement. You know, it's not going to solve all the problems. But, you know, I think I'm more optimistic in a way, but I think it's important to recognize that just having an agreement is not going to make a huge difference. It's what's that then means in terms of national activities, local activities, and so on. And actually, businesses, you know, they've been pushing quite hard, and that's quite interesting. A lot of businesses have done much more than governments on these issues. Not all, and I'm not going into detail of, you know, but a lot of businesses, they've just identified this, you know, and said, let's stop arguing about, you know, whether the science is right or what exactly is going to happen. For us, it's a risk, and we want to be prepared and take action. Oh, yeah.
In response to climate change-induced natural disasters? Had there been an improvement or development, a change from, say, 5-10 years ago when climate change disasters were not that apparent? Thank you.
Yes, I mean, there is clearly evidence. One example is it's in Africa. It's called the African Risk Capacity. That was launched, I think, last year or 2 years ago. Sponsored by, I think UK was involved, Norway was involved, World Bank involved, and a lot of African countries setting up a pool to provide drought insurance. And they have a longer term outlook. So they want to set up that pool, but they also want to address the underlying issues of, you know, can we change irrigation or cultivation practices? You know, we have the pool, but we also need to take action. So that's one example. Then you have agriculture insurance at a smaller scale. I mentioned this forecast insurance, for example, that was being a lot of, interestingly, a lot of satellite imagery has helped to create new insurance products. So it's called index insurance. So you buy an insurance policy that will pay out when there is less rainfall, or that will pay out when there is too much rainfall. But you don't have to prove that you've pays any loss. So you can, you know, you get your money because there's too little rainfall. So you don't have to prove that that has impacted on your crops, and you don't have a lengthy negotiation with your insurer. They just pay because this parametric trigger was caused. And